The legislative session started 2 months ago with much of the buzz around how to reconfigure the state's Child Protective Services Agency. That's still in the mix, but a lot more has been going on. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Democratic Representative Chad Campbell and Republican Representative J.D. Mesnard about the session so far, including what bills have died and which are still going strong, and when we can expect a budget agreement. Plus, a home designed by Frank Lloyd Wright in New Jersey is being moved bit by bit to Arkansas to keep it from facing further weather-related damage. Where does that fit into the big picture of historic preservation? And as spring training has changed over the years in the Valley, so have the way numbers are used in Major League Baseball. I'll talk with economist Andrew Zimbalist about his new book, The Sabermetric Revolution. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Secretary of State John Kerry says he's going to meet his Russian counterpart later this week to try again to see if there's a way to defuse the crisis in Ukraine. But first, he's consulting Ukraine's interim prime minister, who's here in Washington. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has details.
At a budget hearing on Capitol Hill, Kerry announced plans to travel to London, where he says he will meet Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Friday and present him with a set of choices.
It can get ugly fast if the wrong choices are made.
He's warning Russia it will face sanctions and diplomatic isolation if it does not take, as he puts it, a diplomatic off-ramp and instead continue steps to either annex Crimea or promote its secession. Kerry says the U.S. recognizes Russia's interest in Ukraine, particularly in Crimea, but adds nothing justifies Russia's military intervention. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says there are no plans to extend past the end of this month the deadline for uninsured Americans to sign up for medical coverage. People who have not enrolled by then may face penalty. NPR's Craig Windham reports the administration's goal is to have 6 million people enroll by the end of March.
Enrollments were still nearly 2 million below that target at the start of the month, but Sebelius has told the House Ways and Means Committee the Affordable Care Act is a success even if the goal is not met.
Success looks like millions of people with affordable health coverage, which we will have by the end of March in the private marketplace, in Medicaid, young adults on their family plans.
Sebelius says she expects enrollments to pick up as the deadline approaches. The goal of 6 million signups is lower than the previous target of 7 million, which was revised downward given the problems with the rollout of the Federal Health Marketplace website. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Hundreds of firefighters are on the scene of a massive blaze in Upper Manhattan, where more than a dozen people may still be unaccounted for after an explosion level 2 apartment buildings. At least 2 people were killed. More than 20 others were injured. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio says the blast may have stemmed from a gas leak that was reported just 50 minutes before the explosion. NPR's Joel Rose reports on the public attention not only on this disaster, but also on the way the mayor is handling it.
The mayor took office just a few months ago. This has been the first real test of the city's emergency response under his stewardship. We've had a number of major snowstorms, but that's not exactly the same as a breaking emergency situation like this. The mayor canceled all of his public appearances for the day, got up here very quickly, held a long press conference, appeared to take this very, very seriously.
NPR's Joel Rose reporting. At last check on Wall Street, Dow is down 21 points at 16,330. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com. Offering tools to manage online reviews for medical professionals and small businesses. Learn more at reputation.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A bill in the Arizona legislature to allow surprise inspections of abortion clinics is set for its first hearing in the Senate. The bill has been described by supporters as a vital tool for health inspectors who now must get a warrant to make unannounced searches of abortion providers. The Arizona Department of Health Services has sought only one abortion clinic search warrant in the past 4 years. It happened just days before the bill was heard in the House of Representatives last month. House Bill 2284 passed the House last week. It's due to be heard by the Senate Health and Human Services Committee today. The Navajo Nation Council Speaker and his predecessor have pleaded not guilty to bribery and conspiracy charges. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
Speaker Johnny Nays and former Speaker Lawrence Morgan entered their pleas in Window Rock District Court. Prosecutors have accused the two and other tribal officials of being part of a scheme to divert money to their families. The tribe's discretionary fund was set up to aid Navajos facing extreme hardships and prohibited nepotism. 16 people have been criminally charged in the case. Another dozen face ethics violations. Some of them have pleaded guilty and agreed to aid prosecutors with their cases against other defendants. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
The Arizona Department of Corrections and the U.S. Bureau of Land Management say they will conduct a horse adoption event in Florence this week. Officials say up for adoption will be 25 wild horses, 10 wild burros, 3 saddle-trained horses, and 2 pack-trained burros. The event is set for Friday and Saturday at the Wild Horse and Burro Training Facility in Florence. The Department of Corrections has partnered with the federal government to allow prison inmates to work with the animals to ensure they're ready for public adoption. A public viewing of the horses and burros begins Friday morning, and adoptions are set for Saturday.
KJZZ is supported by 5R Cha Thai Bistro in Mesa on Wrecker and McKellips, serving lunch and dinner 7 days a week with happy hour from 3 to 5 p.m. and a full selection of wines. Menus and delivery at 5rchathai.com.
Look for mostly sunny skies across the valley today. We should see a high around 81 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with an overnight low in the mid-50s. A few clouds tomorrow with a high of 79. Right now, with 13% relative humidity, mostly sunny in Phoenix and at 74 degrees at 11:06.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Governor Jan Brewer has named 2 new members of the Arizona Board of Regents, which governs the state's public universities. I'll talk with former Regent Chris Hurstam about what the job entails and how steep the learning curve is. Also, a Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home is being moved bit by bit from New Jersey to Arkansas. How does that fit into the idea of historic preservation? Is it still fulfilling the artist's vision if a home is moved to another location? And spring training baseball has changed a lot over the decades, so is the way statistics are used in the game. I'll talk with economist Andrew Zimbalist about his new book, The Sabermetric Revolution. We start today's program with a review of the 2014 legislative session so far. When the session got underway in January, there was a lot of buzz about what should be changed about Arizona's Child Protective Services Agency. That's still in the mix, but then considerable attention at the Capitol turned to SB 1062, the controversial religious freedom bill vetoed by Governor Brewer. So where do things stand in the legislature right now, and what else, other than the all-important budget, remains to be done? I'm joined by House Minority Leader Chad Campbell. Chad, good morning.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. First, any surprise? Governor Brewer is not going to challenge the Constitution and run for a third term.
No, none whatsoever. I think that was probably the worst-kept secret in Arizona, so I think we all knew that was coming.
So you weren't too excited about the press conference today or anything like that?
No, not really. No offense to Governor Brewer, but no.
Chad, let's review the legislative session so far. What are your views overall? How involved have Democrats been?
Well, we've been involved, but we've been involved for all the wrong reasons. 1062 was a great example. We had to kind of head that off at the pass and make sure the governor knew why that bill needed to be vetoed. And we haven't been involved in what I think are the real discussions that the state needs, which is funding our schools, figuring out how to put people back to work, and most importantly, probably fixing CPS. And I think that there's conversations going on with a lot of dedicated people down here around CPS, but I am worried that we're not getting out in front of this as quickly as we should be. And it concerns me that we're going to try to do this at the end of session when we're compressed for time, and that scares me a little bit.
That's going to surprise people, considering how much time and effort has been put into CPS or recreating CPS. What do you think the holdup is?
Well, it's difficult, and it's complicated. And again, I think there's a lot of people down here doing a lot of hard work on this issue, and I want to give them the space in the room, and we don't want to get in their way. But I'm concerned, again, that we're not having public discussions about this. I think that we need to start those discussions now rather than later so that we can start to work out the kinks of any plan that we come forth with in April or May. The last thing we need to be doing, though, is come out with a plan in late April, early May that has a lot of problems that we haven't identified, and then we're going to be down here for another month or 2 months trying to fix those problems. We should start that process now.
How many stakeholders, not a particular number, but how many groups of stakeholders need to be involved and at the table on this issue?
Well, I mean, there's a ton. You got the elected officials from the legislature. You have the governor's office. You have the agency head, and Flanagan is the new agency head, obviously. You have the community service providers out in the neighborhoods and out across the community here in Arizona. You've got law enforcement. You've got parent groups. You have a ton of stakeholders from a very diverse set of backgrounds that need to be at the table, and that's part of why this is complicated. But it has to be complicated because it is such an important issue, and so we cannot let those complications or that wide range of stakeholders slow this process down to the point where nothing is getting done.
You brought up SB 1062. How impactful was the overall reaction to that? What kind of a legacy is that going to have for the rest of the session?
Well, I'm hoping it heads off some of these other more extreme bills we're seeing here regarding women's rights, regarding, again, some other bills related to quote-unquote religious freedoms. What I would hope this conversation will do, though, around 1062 is start to kind of reset the state. I want people out in the public to start thinking about who's down here and who they're voting into office and what their priorities are. There was a huge outcry of opposition to 1062 after it passed. And it wasn't just, you know, quote-unquote liberal groups. It wasn't just people from the LGBT community, which were the targets of that horrible piece of legislation. You had the business sector come out against it. You had both of our Republican U.S. senators come out against it. You had sports interests come out against it. You had one of the most diverse coalitions of people I've ever seen come together, more diverse than even around 1070 back in the day, to oppose that piece of legislation. And it shows you how out of touch many of these legislators are down here from the far right side of the spectrum. And more importantly, I think it exposed that the Center for Arizona Policy, and Kathy Herod in particular, have way too much influence over this legislative body, and they do not reflect the vast majority of Arizonans' opinions.
Why does the CAP, why do other certain groups and certain lobbyists have so much more influence? You've been there for a while. Can you take us behind the scenes of what goes on down there? How much time is spent talking to people about how the bill should be written? How many lobbyists are in your office? That kind of thing.
Well, I think the problem we have is we have a legislative map where the vast majority of elections are decided in the primary. And that's true on both sides of the aisle. We just don't have enough competitive general elections at the legislative level. And so what happens is you have the party base, and in particular here in Arizona, because we have more Republicans, the Republican Party base, which, as we all know, is a very far right base at this point in time. They're controlling who gets elected out of their party. There's no competition in the general because the numbers from the other party don't allow for competition. And so you have a small, extreme section of the Republican Party who's now electing the legislative body for the most part. And that's what we've seen. There's a disconnect. You have a very socially conservative body down here from the Republican side. There's very few moderates left. They're driven by ideology. And you don't have the traditional old school Republicans that we think of that were about promoting business interests, that were about, you know, small government, stay out of our personal lives. It's a very different kind of Republican down at the Capitol these days.
Representative Campbell, there are going to be some changes. There were some announced yesterday in leadership as far as the House is concerned because people are leaving to run for other offices or whatnot. How is that going to affect your caucus through the rest of this session, if at all?
I don't think it'll affect us. We had Representative Gallego step down from leadership because he's going to run for Congress. Representative Wheeler took his place, and Representative Meyer now took Representative Wheeler's place. Representative Meyer has been down here for many years. He's experienced. He's one of the best legislators you could ask for in the state. I don't care if you're Democrat or Republican. And I'm thrilled to have him on the leadership team. And I think we're going to have a very unified and very effective caucus moving forward.
But the fact that this is an election year, people are always wondering about, are they going to try to get out early? Does that affect how work is done? Are you going to see any of that?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. Okay. I'm not running for office
right,
this year, so it's nice.
You're not running for Congress or governor, huh? Nothing.
I'm not running for Congress, not running for governor. I'll be back at some point, but it is nice to be taking a bit of a break, I'm not going to lie. I would hope that we don't let the election cycle get in the way of enacting good policy. And we can't rush some of these decisions, especially CPS and especially the budget. We're at a very critical moment in our state's history where we're recovering from this recession, and we have an opportunity to start reinvesting and moving the state forward or continuing down this path we've been down the past few years, which is really taking away the services and really kind of undercutting an effective government at the expense of the taxpayers. And that cannot continue. So I hope we take our time. I don't want to waste time and waste taxpayer money by being down here for too long. Don't get me wrong. But let's not rush it, just so we can go out and campaign. That should be the last thing in anybody's mind down here.
Well, final offshoot then, as far as the budget is concerned, do you expect Democrats to be in on the negotiations, or is this going to be, okay, this is basically what we've decided. Do you like it? Do you want to tweak it? What not?
I would hope we're at the table. I think that there's a lot of common interests. I know that the Speaker and I have some shared interests in terms of restoring HERF dollars, which is for infrastructure, trying to increase salaries for DPS and some other public safety employees. I think there are some overlapping interests this year on higher education as well. So I'm hopeful that the Democrats are at the table. We were at the table last year, obviously, and I think the budget that came out was a very bipartisan budget, very moderate. It was started to reinvest in the state but didn't bankrupt us, and I would like to see us continue that path again this year. I think that we can start to put money back into schools, fix CPS, do all of the things we need to do in this state without raising any taxes and without bankrupting us in the future. That is possible, and I think we can get it done, and I'm hopeful that we'll be at the table with the governor when that starts to happen.
House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. For another perspective on the 2014 legislative session so far, I turn to Republican Representative J.D. Mesnard, who's also House Speaker pro tem. Representative Mesnard, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Wanted to get a quick reaction to Governor Brewer's announcement today. She's not going to be running again. What are your thoughts?
I wish her the best as she transitions into a new phase in her life. And, she's been an effective governor down here and I've enjoyed working with her. And again, wish her the best in her future.
From a general point of view, what are your descriptions of the 2014 legislative session so far? One issue that came up with Representative Campbell is the idea of doing something different with CPS. There's been a lot of discussion on that. Are you concerned that things haven't moved more quickly?
You know, I'm not concerned things haven't moved more quickly because we should be thoughtful down here, especially with an issue as critical as CPS. Between my being elected and before that being on staff, I've seen CPS come and go as an issue. It seems to be a cyclical thing. Every 3 or 4 years, there's a major event or a series of events that causes us to take a look, and we make some tweaks, some fixes, and then 3 or 4 years later, we're back here again. I'm hoping that that stops. And to get to that point, you have to be thoughtful in what you develop, and I think we are being thoughtful.
Any other issues that have not gotten enough attention from the media, from other people, that you think need to be discussed based on the first couple of months of the session?
I don't think so. This has been CPS has been a major issue, but it's been a relatively tame session, I would say. It doesn't have quite the drama that last year's session had with the Medicaid expansion debate. So this has been relatively tame. I think you've seen a few issues that have caught, national attention and fairly or unfairly, but otherwise it's been relatively tame.
Well, there's been extensive reporting on the increased efforts of business groups during the session. That came up as far as SB 1062. Have
Sure.
you noticed that? And if so, does it affect in any way how you do your job as a lawmaker?
I don't think I've seen any additional involvement than I would normally see from the business community and others. With 1062, there was some frustration because the involvement seemed to happen at the very tail end or really after the vote. And we always are interested in getting feedback, and there have been very little prior to the vote. So that was a bit frustrating, and we'll see where we go from here next session or in future years. But I would say that they have a prominent presence down here. I've worked with them on a number of my bills. I don't think their level of involvement is high or low for how it's been in the past.
There were a few members of the state Senate who wrote a letter to Governor Brewer on SB 1062, and that got some people concerned about the work that lawmakers have to do, how busy you are, how many bills there are, and whether you actually have a chance to go through the legislation as many people would like. Is that an issue? Are things pushed through sometimes where you don't have a chance to really, really get down and dirty into what a particular bill may mean or not?
The puzzling thing about that was that the bill really wasn't new. You actually had some variation or iteration of it for the 2 years prior. And really, part of the reason we pushed it through a little bit faster, but still not exceptionally fast, it was still 6 weeks into session before it went up to the governor's office. But part of the reason we moved it a little more quickly was because it really was seen by many of us, including myself, as a carryover from last session. A bill similar to this went up. It got vetoed, but not on the merits of the bill. It got vetoed because it was a part of a group of bills that went up during the Medicaid expansion debate, and so that's why it was vetoed. So the idea was to come and let's take, let's get this back up to the governor and get this off the table and move on to other things. So it's a little puzzling, those who have indicated they were unaware or unsure, or didn't have time to read the bill or take a look at the issue as much as they would have. I think really at the end of the day, they were as surprised as I was and others that it happened so late into the game. Usually, if there's going to be some controversy, we begin hearing about it. If the business community has a particular interest, we begin hearing about it right away. And this bill was dropped, you know, early in the session, and moved through at a relatively steady pace, and then sat there for a while, just kind of waiting to be voted on for a number of weeks. And so I think what they're expressing more than anything is just sort of the puzzlement with what happened there at the end.
Regardless of your support and the support of many others for SB 1062, are you concerned that the national reputation of Arizona has been hurt?
I think the national reputation took a beating. I'm not sure it was entirely fair, but you know, it is what it is. I think that the coverage of it really didn't try to look at the merits of the bill. I mean, I think very few people heard of the letter that came from, 10, 11 law professors from schools like Harvard, Stanford, Pepperdine, and others that said, here's the legal situation that courts and others are dealing with, and that's why this bill has merit. But few people heard about that. It became something about discrimination. It became something about same-sex marriage and other issues that really, it was not intended to be targeting. It was mainly meant to be a religious liberty issue. Again, something we'd seen the last 2 years in various forms. And so I don't think the coverage was fair, but it is what it is. And at that point, the perception was bad. And so for that reason, yeah, we probably took a hit.
But how careful do lawmakers have to be as it relates to perception? Obviously, you're down there to do a job. Your job is not to think about what the media is going to cover. And yet at the same time, you're representing Arizona. You obviously want to represent Arizona well. And some people will say, boy, why does a legislature spend time on things like this when there's a budget to be done, there's CPS to be fixed? Is that a fair criticism?
I don't think it's a fair criticism unless we aren't working on the budget. And maybe because folks only hear about these sorts of bills because they're interesting, they're going to get headlines, they're dramatic, they're emotional, they're controversial. Maybe they assume that we're only focusing on that and not the budget. We began focusing on the budget last fall. It is a long and arduous process to put a budget together. It's still ongoing. Again, it's about being thoughtful, and we are going to be looking at all the different areas of government and how we fund it. You know, I often joke that we can, in fact, multitask. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. There are 90 of us down here at the legislature working on a variety of issues. Some will rise to the level of controversy that 1062 did. Others will go below the radar and no one will know the difference. But at the end of the day, the budget is still being negotiated. It's ongoing. I think the criticism would be fair if we were just sitting on our thumbs and not really doing much in the way of the budget, but we are working on it every day.
Republican Representative J.D. Mesnard, also House Speaker pro tem. Representative Mesnard, thanks for the time.
You bet. Good to be here.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about Governor Jan Brewer's two new appointees to the Board of Regents. And later this hour, Sabermetrics taking over baseball. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, a Catholic Benedictine healthcare educator for over 100 years, and now at the Communiversity in Surprise, Arizona. go.css.edu/AZ.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. BBC News Hour comes your way at 1 o'clock. Checking temperatures around the state right now, it's sunny and 41 degrees in Flagstaff, sunny and 55 in Prescott. 68 degrees and sunny skies in Casa Grande. It's sunny and 73 in Tucson and mostly cloudy and 71 degrees in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Thomas and Zona Lorig and Robert Dixon, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Under mostly sunny skies, it's 74 degrees at KJZZ at 1124.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On Tuesday afternoon, Governor Brewer's office made public her latest appointments to the Arizona Board of Regents, which governs the state's public universities. The two new regents, once confirmed by the state Senate, will be Ronald Schupman, who takes the seat of outgoing Regent Dennis DeConcini, and William Ridenour, who will succeed Ann Mariucci. With me to talk about the Board of Regents and what kind of on-the-job training there will be is Chris Hurstom, former president of the Regents. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Chris, quickly, any surprise Governor Brewer is not going to challenge the Constitution and run for a third term?
No, I don't think there's any surprise at all when you consider that at least 90% of the election lawyers already have opined that she couldn't run again. So I don't think that's a surprise.
What are the greatest challenges of being a member of the Board of Regents? What's the learning curve like?
Well, I think the learning curve, frankly, we got to remember, when you go on the Board of Regents, it's an 8-year term. Some people call it an 8-year sentence because it is so long and it's very time consuming, but it's very important. And you always politically outlive the governor that appoints you. And these two new individuals, Shoopman and Ridenour, they're going to outlive the governor a full 7 years because she's in her last year in office. I think the learning curve, frankly, is about 2 years. I think once you go through two annual cycles of tuition hearings and university budget approvals and perhaps the hiring of a new president, which incidentally is going to take place in the near future because the NAU presidency search is now underway since the NAU president's retiring. Once you go through that for a couple of years, then you are very well prepared, very experienced for the last 6 years of your term.
Chris, as you mentioned, an 8-year sentence. So even though you're not paid to be a regent, it is a job of sorts. How many meetings are there? How much time do you have to spend on it on a monthly basis?
Wow, it all depends on what committees you serve and how active they are. I always found during my 8-year term that I had to dedicate really the equivalent about one day a week. When you average it out over the course of the year. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but like in the case of these two gentlemen and most regents, they have other jobs. And so you basically have to dedicate as much as, 20% of your professional time for 8 years. So it's a major investment, but you do it because you're looking after the crucial three university public higher education system in our state, and there are very few areas of public policy making more important than that.
Chris, at its core, you're not a rubber stamp guy in any way, but I'm going to ask this anyway. This idea that there are appointees by a particular governor, and then you have university presidents who come to you, whether it's for tuition or various other things. So how much of it is basically, okay, unless we hear something we really don't like, we're going to go along with this?
Well, I think they're like a board of directors over the university system, and there are three CEOs, three presidents of those universities. And like most effective boards, you don't want to micromanage. You don't want to get into the weeds with individual policy decisions. You let your CEOs do that. So what you do is you set very broad-based policy objectives for those three university presidents, and then give them flexibility to attain those objectives. Having said that, which sounds like something from a business management textbook, let me just tell you, when I was asked, what do the regents really do? I know that my colleagues and the ABOR staff did not like this answer, but I still think it applies. The thing that the common individual in Arizona is affected most by regents is they set tuition every single year, and they hire and fire university presidents. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty important things all by themselves. But there is an enormous policy-setting a task that the regents have to do, and then let the three university presidents do their thing.
Chris, as you mentioned, the latest two appointees will outlast Governor Brewer by about 7 years. And I want to close with this question. Since this is a board basically, I guess except for Lou Anne Leonard, made up entirely of Governor Brewer's appointees, what does that mean, if anything, for higher education in Arizona? Does it matter? Will there be more agreement? That sort of thing.
Well, it's an enormous legacy by a governor that they have so many appointees that will, in a sense, outlive them politically. But I have found that effective regents, the most effective regents, are those that are not immersed in political ideological causes, that are willing to dedicate the time that's necessary, and most importantly, that are independent thinkers. And so it really doesn't matter what governor appointed you. You're there for the long haul, and the key is not to be parochial, to be concerned about the entire university system as a whole, and don't get involved in providing goodies for one university and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious to me that these last two appointees, Shoopman and Ridenour, they have strong Arizona roots. They are very experienced in public policy making over the last several years. They appreciate higher education. And I think these are two very, very good appointments by the governor.
Chris Hurstam, among many other things, former president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Chris, thanks.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Tomorrow, former Fiesta Bowl CEO John Junker will be sentenced in U.S. District Court for his role in a campaign finance scandal that hurt the Bowl's reputation and nearly led to its removal from college football's national championship rotation. Those in charge of the Bowl now seem to think the bad times are in the rearview mirror, as evidenced by the departure of Executive Director Robert Shelton, who helped reestablish good feelings about the Bowl. Arizona Republic reporter Craig Harris has reported extensively on the Fiesta Bowl and is with me now. How significant is the sentencing of John Junker in putting some sort of, I don't know, a bow on this whole scandal?
Well, the sentencing is kind of the final chapter, so to speak, in the whole Fiesta Bowl scandal, which has lasted, you know, now 4 years running. And Mr. Junker, when he's sentenced on Thursday, could be the only person to actually serve prison time through this whole scandal. So that would make it significant. And it also would kind of bring to a close this whole affair that's gone on.
Ultimately, how much responsibility does Junker take in everything that went on? Was he, for lack of a better term, the mastermind?
Well, there's two schools of thought on that. He has taken responsibility in that, yeah, he was the CEO, and he takes responsibility that it was him who was involved in this scheme in which employees there at the Bowl were reimbursed for making campaign contributions. He and others have put the blame on a lobbyist named Gary Husk that he was involved. Mr. Husk has denied any involvement whatsoever and Mr. Husk was never charged in the Fiesta Bowl scandal, but was also, he was charged and he pled guilty to a misdemeanor for a similar scheme that occurred at his lobbying firm, Husk Partners. So, you know, Mr. Junker has taken responsibility. He has pled guilty to two felonies, one in federal court and one in the state court system. So, you know, he has taken responsibility that he was the person in charge of it.
Craig, regardless of all the money that was used, the campaign finance scandal, did this become a major story because of the interest people tend to have in things like, why was this money spent on lavish birthday parties? Why was this money being spent in strip clubs?
What happened is the campaign finance scandal opened up the door to a myriad of other questionable spending practices that went on at the Fiesta Bowl, including, as you pointed out, trips by Mr. Junker and others at Bowl going to strip clubs and using Bowl funds for that, having a lavish birthday party at Pebble Beach, California for him. He had four golf club memberships. He sent the number two person on a trip to Europe. There were also questions of how they were bonusing folks and giving out gift cards. And so the campaign finance scandal opened up the door for a lot of other questionable spending. Now, the questionable spending was he was never charged with anything on that. You know, he was reported to have paid the IRS back money on expenses that he had, but, you know, that's up between Mr. Junker and the IRS. So, you know, the questionable spending is kind of what gets the headlines, you know, the strip clubs, the big birthday bashes. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what he has pled guilty to is a campaign finance violation, which are both felonies.
Craig, you followed this for a long time, and based on your reporting and based on the people you've talked to, what's the reputation of the Fiesta Bowl now, and is the reputation hurt at all by the departure of Robert Shelton?
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, Robert Shelton came in. He's the former University of Arizona president who was hired to replace John Junker, and by all accounts, did a fantastic job. He kept the Bowl in the BCS. He got the Bowl into the new organization called College Football Playoff. He also secured a national championship team that's going to be here in 2 years for the Fiesta Bowl. So when he was asked to leave earlier this year, it was really kind of raised some eyebrows and kind of was a head scratcher. He still had a year and a half plus left on his contract. And so there was some real kind of questions what was going on. You know, he left gracefully and took his buyout and went to go work in Tucson. And so right now the bull is being run by Dwayne Woods, who is the former chairman of the board, and he's the interim director. And, you know, the bull right now is on really pretty good financial ground. They've got about $26 million in net assets socked away. They're in the new college football playoff, and they're going to have a championship game. So they're looking for an executive director right now, and they seem to be in a pretty good shape.
Now, we mentioned the new executive director. Any idea what direction they're going with that?
You know, there was a clear difference with Robert Shelton and John Junker, of course. You know, Robert Shelton, of course, you know, no pun intended, he was a rocket scientist. He had a PhD. He was a very brilliant man. Much different than John Junker, who basically has a journalism degree from ASU and worked his way up to be one of the most powerful men in college football. So I don't know what direction they want to go. You know, when I wrote the story about Dr. Shelton leaving, they said they wanted someone that could do a little bit more marketing or do something in that area. I'm not quite sure what they want to do for more marketing. They have an incredible brand, but, I mean, that's their choice. They've got really strong, good board members. You know, I think their chairman right now is Andy McCain, who's the son of U.S. Senator John McCain. I mean, I think they're in pretty good hands. So they'll have to make their choice on where they want to go and what they want to do. I mean, they're pretty locked up for the next, you know, 12 years of being in this college football playoff. So there's not a whole lot they have to do to maintain their elite status. They're already in the game, so to speak.
Arizona Republic investigative reporter Craig Harris. You can follow him on Twitter at CHarrisAZRep. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Discussing the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright and his creations has grown more energetic in recent years in the Valley. The possibility of a redesign of a house Wright built for his son and daughter-in-law led to passionate efforts to preserve the house and eventually to a sale to an owner who wouldn't make dramatic changes. The latest edition of The New Yorker includes a story on a New Jersey couple who bought a Wright-designed home and planned to stay in it forever until Hurricanes Floyd and Irene led to concerns that it would be damaged severely by weather. So the couple sold the house to Walmart heiress Alice Walton, and it's being moved bit by bit in three tractor trailers to Arkansas, where it'll be preserved in a museum. With me for a few minutes to talk about that is writer and architecture critic Walt Lockley. Walt, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
So how does this New Jersey home fit into the whole of Frank Lloyd Wright's career, his designs?
Well, this is a Usonian house. It was built in near Princeton in the middle of New Jersey in the mid-50s. And it's one of about 25 Usonian houses that Wright designed between the late 30s and up until his death. There are about 25 of them, and they're all similar in that they are relatively low-cost and relatively simple houses for people with small budgets. You can say whatever else you want to about Wright, but he always had his door open for people with small budgets, and he always considered that a good use of his talents and a good challenge for his design genius.
Why are Wright's designs still so impactful? Why are so many people drawn to them?
Well, I think there's two parts to Wright's career, and this is really the only problem that I have with this house being saved. One part of Wright's career is his individual genius, and there's no getting around it. I personally tried to resist the idea for a long time because I'm sort of contrary, but he really was an authentic genius. If you get past all of the self-promotion and all of the gossip and all of the, you know, allegations about his personality and all that stuff, at the bottom of all that pile, he's still a genius. The other part of his career, though, is that he founded a school, and he ran that school for 30 years. He founded it in the Depression, and I'm talking about Taliesin. Mm-hmm. And in that school, he had dozens and scores of very talented people working for him and vying for his attention and arguing with each other and experimenting on themselves and each other. And all of that accumulated, you know, practical expertise. That's not genius exactly, but it does constitute an unprecedented sort of source book for design ideas. And the genius is gone, and we still have the design ideas, we still have Taliesin available to us. Now, this house in New Jersey, I don't think it's a work of art. That's the only problem I have with it, you know, being taken to Bentonville, Arkansas, and put in an art museum and regarded as an irreplaceable object. I think that separates people from the real helpful, useful, relevant design ideas that are still in these Usonian houses.
And while it may not apply to a Usonian house, but with Wright's creations, at least the way a lot of us see him, the creations tended to fit into nature where they were built. Does moving the house then, in fact, take away some of the reasons it would have been built in Princeton in the first place?
Yeah, that gets to the preservation argument. Are you really preserving something if you move it to Arkansas?
Yeah.
In this case, probably not, because the Usonian houses, they're not all, you know, cookie cutters, but they're all very similar. And there's not going to be a whole lot about this house that you know, responds to that specific site. That's in contrast to the David Wright house that you led in with. That house was designed for the desert, for its site in Arcadia. And I think we should all thank Scott Jarson and the others who pulled together and saved that house. That house, on the other hand, is, you know, a unique work that's tailored to its site and really is irreplaceable.
In the New Yorker piece, the couple that has sold the house was talking about how closely they had bonded with it. Almost, they'd lived there for more than 20 years, and it had been something that was really important to them. But in a real spiritual sense, does that hit you as someone who's into design and into architecture? And does it hit you more because it's a Wright house, or could that happen with countless numbers of designers and architects?
There's something about Wright. You can look at all these, you know, practical. There's a whole long list of, you know, of this expertise about the built-in furniture and how it saves space and the manipulation of scale and all those tricks. But there is something undeniably humane and touching about experiencing a Wright house. And I envy the people who are able to live there, because they're in a constant conversation with something that's almost better than nature.
His legend continues to grow, and I want to follow up with this as well. When you hear about this particular house, even as you said, it's not necessarily one of his more unique ones, how has his legacy continued to be affected by stories like this?
Stories that his house is being moved?
Yeah, this idea that it gets this much attention that, as you said, it's not quite the same as preserving a house as the David Wright house was, and yet, because it's a Wright house, it still draws so much energy, so much passion.
Well, his reputation is secure. That there's no doubt in my mind that he's going to continue to be regarded as the greatest American architect of the 20th century, and maybe for all time. The more we talk about him and the more we observe his lessons, the better off we are. The only worry that I have is that people, you know, maybe want to attend to him for, you know, their own reasons, and they perhaps imagine themselves with as much latitude or as much, you know, opportunity for self-expression. They want to put themselves in his shoes, maybe. But he can accommodate that, too. Again, the more we pay attention to him, the better off we are.
Writer and architecture critic Walt Lockley talking about Frank Lloyd Wright. Walt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up in a couple of minutes on Here and Now, we'll talk about another Arizona legend, Cesar Chavez. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Community Foundation, offering flexible tax-advantaged giving options for Arizonans to support the causes that speak to their hearts, on the web at azfoundation.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. We should see mostly to partly sunny skies in Phoenix today, a high around 81 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with a low of 55, mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 79. At 12, we'll have NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, low-income schools are succeeding where others fail. despite or maybe because of problems the kids face. And we'll get the latest on the search for a missing Malaysia Airlines plane. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies right now in Phoenix, 13% relative humidity, and it's 74 degrees at KJZZ at 11:45.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Tomorrow at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Phoenix, a new film about the life of Cesar Chavez will be screened. Cesar Chavez, with the tagline "History is made one step at a time," stars Michael Peña and John Malkovich and is directed by Diego Luna. The film is not a documentary, but a dramatic depiction. To talk about the real Chavez and his impact, I'm joined by Jose Cortez, a former Chavez labor organizer. He's putting together an event as well for March 27th to teach younger generations about Chavez. Jose, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. First of all, I wanted to get your reaction to this idea of a new dramatic film about Chavez. Are you excited about that? Are you worried about how factual it'll be?
Definitely, I'm excited because anything that allows for the community to learn more about the legacy of Chavez is fabulous. This is something that I and several other activists that were very close to Cesar have been doing for many years. Ever since the death of Cesar, we've been trying to find the ways to promote the legacy of Cesar.
What do you think the greatest part of his legacy is, if you could lump it into one thing? And do we talk enough about him, as far as you're concerned?
After Cesar's death, there was a lot of talk about him and his, and his accomplishments. But as the years went by, there was less and less. And this was one of the reasons why I and other individuals who were close to Cesar, we were actually the ones that were following him when he was organizing here in Arizona in the late 60s and early 70s. We wanted to do more to promote the legacy of Cesar, and that's why we went to Santa Rita where he fasted, and we began to clean it up, refurbish it, making it look halfway decent, so that people could come and see where he fasted and learn more of his philosophy and the great things that he had done for Arizona.
As I mentioned, later this month you'll be having an event to teach kids more about Chavez. There were some very complex issues even for adults. So what are some of the events you want to make sure that kids understand about his legacy?
Well, one of the, we know that Cesar was here to fight for migrant workers' rights, and the impact of a phrase that was created, I should say was born while he was fasting at Santa Rita. One of the individuals that worked closely with Cesar was Dolores Huerta, and while Cesar was fasting, she was out talking to the farm workers, and while talking to the farm workers, they would tell her, Dolores Huerta, you may have organized in California, but this is Arizona. Things are much harder here. You can't organize here in Arizona. And her response to the workers that would say this to her was, si se puede. Yes, it can. It can be done. And so as she went back and told this to Cesar while he was fasting, it made sense. Here we are. We're sacrificing for something that we truly believe in. And even the people have a certain amount of reluctance in believing what we're doing. But I think that if we stick to this phrase, si se puede, it can be done, it will definitely have an impact. And that impact is definitely was felt during the immigration marches when we had those huge immigration marches where we had thousands of people marching. All you could hear was the chant, si se puede. And taking it even further, during his campaigning, President Obama used that famous phrase, si se puede, to rally around. And not knowing that this phrase which is such a simple little phrase, had its origin right here in Phoenix, in a very humble neighborhood, very poor neighborhood, which was Campito. And it was right there in Santa Rita where it was born. So I would say, you know, just to summarize it in one sentence, Si Se Puede has definitely been something that has impacted Arizona, and not only Arizona, but also the nation. And this is one of the things that we want to make sure that our kids learn, you know, because I know a lot of kids, you know, they're out there playing and they say it, but they don't even know that it was born right here in Arizona, right here in Phoenix, right here in one of the humble, poor neighborhoods where Cesar passed it.
Jose Cortez, a former labor organizer for Cesar Chavez. He's putting together an event for March 27th to teach younger generations about Chavez. And tomorrow night at the Orpheum Theater, a new film about the life of Cesar Chavez will be screened. Jose, thank you for the time today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Spring training games got started late last month, and watching those games for the average fan really hasn't changed very much over the years. But the way scouts, coaches, and managers watch the game is dramatically different, as the use of statistics has come to dominate baseball and how teams decide how to spend their money. Economist Andrew Zimbalist is a professor at Smith College, and he's written a number of books about the economy of sports. His latest is called The Sabermetric Revolution. I asked him to define sabermetrics.
Sabermetrics is the application of statistical analysis to assess baseball player performance and team strategy and also team business decision-making.
Teams have been thinking about statistics. They've been using statistics in some fashion or form for decades. What has changed over the past, 10 to 20 years in terms of the numbers they look for and how they use them?
One could trace it back really to the 1870s and the 1880s when baseball first starts, that people are suggesting new statistics and using new statistics. And that goes right through the 1930s and 40s. Branch Rickey at the Dodgers hired Alan Roth, who was promoting the idea of using on-base percentage, which is batting average plus walks, essentially. But it never got picked up by more than a team or two until the 1990s. And then when Michael Lewis writes his book about the 2002 Oakland A's, and this, of course, is a team on a shoestring budget that ends up winning their division in the American League and winning something like 20 games in a row. So it caught everybody's notice. And Lewis is suggesting some very simple things that teams should start to do. Nothing very complicated, nothing that involved advanced math. And one of those main things that he's suggesting is, why don't teams use on-base percentage instead of batting average? Because after all, if a player walks rather than gets a base hit, he still gets to first base. He still allows another batter to come up. If there's anybody on base, those runners might advance. And he prolongs the inning. So all of those wonderful things happen for a walk, and yet for decades and decades, baseball front offices were emphasizing and prioritizing batting average rather than on-base percentage. And once Lewis reveals this stuff, teams and by the way, back in 2002, 2003, you can hire somebody who did sabermetrics for an online site like Baseball Prospectus. You could hire them for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, you know, and they're paying players $2-4 million on average. Why not hire a sabermetrician? You could be accused almost of malpractice for not hiring somebody at $30,000 a year to do this. And basically, it works. The evidence we have is that the early sabermetric insights help teams select players better. Now, there are two things to say about that going forward. One is that once you have a new metric, like on-base percentage, that is making it obvious to teams that they should be doing this, then even though prior to 2003, when Moneyball was published, there's not much demand for players with high on-base percentage, afterwards, there is a lot of demand, and that high demand for those players raises the price of those players. So back when Billy Beane at the Oakland A's was looking at on-base percentage, it was undervalued, and players with high on-base percentages you could get on the cheap. But 3 or 4 years later, they became too expensive. and so that kind of category from that metric wasn't very valuable anymore. In fact, you could say it was almost counterproductive. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that a statistic like on-base percentage, which, as I said, is basically batting average plus walks, is very easy to understand. You don't need much more than a fourth or fifth grade mathematical background to grasp that. But what happens is that all of the low-hanging fruit gets picked in 2000, from 2002 up to maybe 2007 or 8. And now, in order to get a leg up, in order for a sabermetric element in a front baseball front office to actually do something that nobody else is doing, you've got to engage in much more sophisticated sabermetric analysis.
Can the new age sabermetricians get along with the old school managers, the guys, the scouts who actually see on the field and they know more about the game per se?
Moneyball is wrong on a large number of issues that it brings up. And one of the issues where it misleads, I think very significantly misleads, is on this relationship between the newfangled sabermetricians and the old-fangled scouts. In most baseball front offices, the general manager of the team and the head of baseball operations, they get together and they say, look, there's no reason to tie a hand behind our backs here. Let's use both of our hands. Let's use the scouting hand and let's use the statistical or sabermetric hand and let's work together. And the good organizations do that. And one of the things that's interesting that we found in looking at this in the book is that the teams that are most sabermetrically inclined are also the teams that have the smartest front offices, because it's people who are really smart who don't get threatened by new ideas because they feel secure in themselves. And so it's those teams where you have somebody really smart in the front office who says, basically, I insist that you work together.
The word innovation is applying to baseball as it does in Silicon Valley and many other industries. Do people still have that stereotype of front offices, whether it's baseball, football, basketball, being run by people who aren't deep thinkers, aren't innovators? But are we seeing that baseball is actually just as on the cutting edge as some of these other industries?
It's certainly the case that if you look at the people who are hired as general managers, who are hired as vice presidents of baseball operations, who are hired as sabermetricians, that the educational background that these people have is much, much higher than it was 20 or 30 years ago. 20 or 30 years ago, you hired an ex-player who might or might not have had a bachelor's degree from college. But now things are much more sophisticated, and not only in the baseball analysis of player analysis side of it, but in business analysis and marketing analysis. All of that stuff is much, much more important. And the baseball industry now is almost a $10 billion industry. It's growing by leaps and bounds. One area where baseball, in fact, is on the cutting edge is its internet wing, which is called MLBAM, or Major League Baseball Advanced Media. They are the dominant force in the industry and one of the dominant forces in telecommunications in terms of streaming and providing new visual and statistical analysis.
When we look at the big picture as far as the sabermetric revolution continuing, do you see that continuing? Do you see it expanding as we find new statistics?
Yes, I think it will continue. You know, one of the things about sabermetrics' productivity in the early 2000s is that, as I said before, they were picking low-hanging fruit. It's very easy to use on-base percentage. It's very easy to use some of the other metrics that were being used. But now it's much, much more difficult. So in order to get that little advantage for your team over the other teams, you've got to expend much more in resources. And not only that, there's no guarantee you're going to find anything. So the productivity that sabermetrics has had over this first 10 years, this first decade since Michael Lewis's book, is not something that I think you can anticipate will be as forthcoming going forward.
Economist Andrew Zimbalist, co-author of the new book, The Sabermetric Revolution. If you happen to be interested in learning more about baseball's advanced statistics, the Society of American Baseball Research, or SABR, is holding its annual analytics conference in Phoenix. It starts tomorrow and runs through Saturday. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg for his help, and thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the program, you can catch it online this afternoon at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to hear individual segments. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by High Health, celebrating American Heart Health Month, helping you change your lifestyle to a healthier you with trained nutritional counselors available at 45 valley-wide locations. High Health, living healthy every day.